Court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Del Valle Independent School District versus Lopez. Is that, no, excuse me, wrong one. I was out of order. Ready to hear argument in Warning Company and others versus...
May it please the Court, Mr. John McCall has been arguing for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the Court, I am John McCall of Dallas. I am grateful for the opportunity to ask this Court to remove the chilling effect that the decision below, which creates a new employment tort for employment decisions, is having on the lawful exercise of employer rights across the state. This case involved a routine business event, a lawful termination of an employment contract existing at will. There was a routine employment dispute. The employer and the employee disagreed over the fairness of the decision to terminate. Based on that, the Court of Appeals found that the intentional retort of intentional infliction of emotional distress can be based solely on an otherwise lawful reason for and lawful manner of the exercise of contract rights. The ruling below cannot stand because, as a matter of law, the exercise of the petitioner's rights in this case did not constitute extreme and outrageous conduct. The effect of the error below is profound. It effectively lowers the threshold level of outrageous conduct in employment relationships, assuming that the tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress exists in this state. It emasculates the employment at will doctrine, which this Court has repeatedly affirmed by providing alternate theories of tort liability. It makes the Court the ultimate personnel department to review and second-guess discharge decisions by employers where there is not a contractual or statutory right involved.
As a general matter, there's no reason why an employer cannot commit a tort during the discharge of an otherwise lawful discharge of an employee.
No, Justice Cornyn, there is no rule of law that would say that a tort could not be committed. I think in Chief Justice Phillips' recent opinion in the Diamond Shamrock Mendez case, he said that the discharge can be accompanied by action that could be construed as a tort, outrageous conduct. This case simply does not rise to the level that would be the expected level based upon the restatement, of course, and based upon the lower court decisions in this state that have existed up to the Coppice Warnick decision. This case will lead to a virtual, to adopt the law school argument, floodgate of litigation. This is the classic case that will open the door to a replacing of contract and statutory claims typically involved in the employment setting to claims of tort liability. As I said earlier, this court has not recognized the tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress in this state. That was again reaffirmed, that lack of recognition in the recent Diamond Shamrock opinion. The lower courts...
Do you have any objection to the recognition of that tort?
Chief Justice, I do. I think that the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim should not be an independent tort. I think that the mental anguish, the emotional distress that is suffered through other tort claims sufficiently remedies the conduct about which the mental anguish or the emotional distress is at issue.
Do you know how many states have expressly rejected the tort?
No, Chief Justice, I do not. I have not counted that.
If it were zero, could you come up with a compelling rationale why Texas should be number one?
I think that the the tort is in the tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress that is raised the various lawsuits, at least those that I've been identified with, is invariably raised in other settings. There are other claims involved, and the intentional infliction of emotional distress is a tort that is raised, for example, in the classic employment litigation to be able to claim punitive damages in a case where there's a statutory discharge, for example, a statutory discharge claim at issue. The objective test that has been offered by the restatement and the other, the lower court, has been to say that the element and the element upon which this court granted the writ of error is conduct that is outrageous in character and is extreme in degree. The basic issue is the defendant's behavior. Was it truly abominable? The attempt to inflict emotional distress is not an issue. The issue is what the employer in this case did or the actor did. The restatement and the other jurisdictions have set out atrocious, utterly intolerable, and beyond all possible bounds of decency as the threshold, as the standard. And there are several examples given in the various cases and in the restatement.
Why don't the facts of this case fit that definition, where we have a 6-year employee with an exemplary record, letters of commendation, was given 5 minutes to clean out her desk, escorted out like a criminal by a security guard to her car? Why doesn't that fit the definition of outrageousness?
Well, the first several points or facts that you raised are simply not outrageous because it's a common event. There are
Are so common that it's we should be desensitized to that type of behavior?
The civility or the desensitization of this court isn't the issue. The issue is what is tolerable in a civilized society. What is tolerable, what is beyond the permissible bounds of decency. And that's society's determination. It happens every day that people are terminated without notice. People are terminated with 6 years, 10 years, 20 years of employment. There's never been a requirement that there in the law that there, or in society, that there be progressive warnings or warnings. And the issue of the escorting is similarly not outrageous. In fact, what the Court of Appeals failed to recognize below and failed to recite to this court, and it is in the record, is that it was common for this particular employer. It was a policy to escort employees off the premises when discharged. This was a government contractor who, for the court's information, made the MREs in Desert Storm. And that was part of their policy. To escort. Security department is involved in that. But there are many employers.
Was that to be sure they didn't take anything with them they weren't supposed to take?
The purpose served is to control the workplace and to control discipline in the workplace.
You mean it keeps everyone else from rioting if they see someone being escorted out by an armed officer? How does that promote discipline in the workplace?
There is no indication that there was an armed officer in the record. This was a security employee in the first place. And secondarily, there is a need to control the workplace. There is a need to control the actions not only of the discharged employee, but the actions of employees who are still in the workplace. In fact, in this particular case, the record again reflects, and the Court of Appeals failed to recite, that the discharged employee who was escorted off the premises told her co-workers that she was not discharged, that she was going on a leave of absence. Now, the employee could have assumed, if the concern is embarrassment, and embarrassment is not atrocious, it is not, embarrassment is not utterly intolerable within a civilized society, but if it were, there was no embarrassment because the employees believed that she was going on a leave of absence.
Even though she has been escorted out by the security officer?
Security escorts people who are sick on the job, who leave on the job, who go on leaves of absence, who leave the premises. The employee said she wasn't discharged. It is a common event for security officers in the employers of this state to escort discharged employees and others off the premises. That is not uncommon.
You have candidly indicated that you do not believe that there should even be an independent TART action for intentional infliction of emotional distress. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You have also said that you believe it is possible to have a TART in connection with the discharge of an employee.
That's correct.
For example, if the employer slaps the employee as they tell them to get out of the place of employment, you would envision that there could be a TART action arising from that physical contact?
Yes.
What about if the employee indicates to the, or the employer indicates to the employee that if you don't get out of here immediately, I'm going to beat the stuffings out of you?
A threat.
A threat that causes emotional distress.
Presumably an assault.
Not any kind of physical contact.
Well, I would interpret beat the stuffing as a physical contact. But
is a threat of physical contact.
Verbal assault.
A verbal assault.
A verbal assault. That would be a tort. And the remedy for that tort would be mental anguish, as traditionally has existed in this state for generations. This court has never found it necessary, and this court is on the certainly this state is on the forefront of commerce and industry in this country, and this court has never found it necessary to regulate employers with an independent tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress.
Well, is it your belief that under the laws that exist in the state of Texas today, a threat to beat the stuffing out of an employee who did not leave immediately with the security guard would be actionable?
As an assault.
As a tort.
As a tort. Yes.
Even though it involved no physical contact.
Well, an assault may not involve physical contact. It's a threat of assault. I mean, a threat of a battery.
I do not read the respondent's brief here to complain so much about the manner in which she was dismissed as about the reason or the lack of reason for it. Why doesn't termination for no reason amount to outrageous conduct?
Because since 1888, in the Erie case, this court has said that termination for no reason is a legitimate exercise of contract right in employment at will context.
What if it's for a bad reason, as is argued in this case, for whistleblowing?
It's argued in this case that it was actually an anticipatory refusal to do something, in lieu of whistleblowing. But good reason, bad reason, or no reason at all, the law in this state is that you can terminate an employment relationship, termination by either the employer or the employee can quit. For good reason, or bad reason, or no reason at all.
Counsel, if we decide, contrary to your wishes, that the Texas Supreme Court does recognize a tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress, do you have any quarrel with the restatement test? And particularly what I'm interested in this context is whether it is for the court, as opposed to the jury, to determine whether the conduct is sufficiently outrageous to be actionable under that standard.
Justice Cornyn, I think the the tort as defined in the restatement I don't have a quarrel with. What I would submit to this court is that in the employment context, that the that there should be the same threshold requirement that would be applied for all torts of intentional infliction of emotional distress. What is discouraging here is that this court, the lower court, lowers the threshold of what's intolerable and what is atrocious. If it were not for the employment relationship, we would not even be here. The reason for the termination is immaterial. It's the exercise of the right and the right to terminate.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The
court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Brinkley Oxford will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, Your Honors, my name is Brinkley Oxford. I'm an attorney practicing law with the law firm of Oxford and Oxford down in Edinburgh, Texas. I start with the proposition that I believe that even Chief Justice Nye in his dissent recognizes the tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress. I believe all of the courts that have looked at this, the appellate courts in Texas, have de facto or actually adopted this tort. As recently as the Sendex v. Dean case, which writ was denied by this court, this tort was alleged, proved by the plaintiff, and approved by the Austin Court of Appeals. It is therefore an answer to the questions that have been posed by the court to the petitioner. Our position that Texas should join the other 28 jurisdictions that have recognized this tort. Chief Justice Phillips noted this in the court's opinion in the Mendez case. Contrary to the distinguished gentleman's argument immediately preceding me and the amicus curiae briefs that have been filed on behalf of the appellants, there will not be a floodgate of lawsuits if we adopt 46 restatement of torts and adopt this intentional infliction of emotional distress.
Mr. Oxford, exactly what was the tort here?
Your Honor, it was a series of events culminating and immediately after the firing or the discharge. As this court knows and as we looked in the 28 opinions that were handed down in the footnote, I believe it was, in the Mendez case, there's a whole bunch of things that can cause the outrage, and that's commonly referred to as outrage, ranging from a racial slur that Chief Justice Nye noted, to the one that the court found in American Medical International that has been cited in the amicus curiae, and that it was a number of events, not one of which in that instance could give rise to the tort. So my answer to it, sometimes it's an immediate event, a racial slur.
But I meant in this instance today.
In this instance, I think there were several factors. First of all, under the circumstances, the discharge of the employee under all of the circumstances, and I think that's highly important as the Court of Appeals laid out in its opinion, and the conduct immediately after of escorting the person off by security guards, and I'm not sure whether it was mentioned whether in the record whether the security guard was armed or not, but I would somewhat disagree with the petitioner's position that employees are escorted off as a daily basis in Texas.
Was that the usual custom for this company to escort a discharged employee out of the
office? No, it was not.
Was that shown in the trial?
Your Honor, I would be less than candid if I didn't tell you. Her deposition was 1 week long. It was over 5.5 days, some of them running 8.5 hours. I don't remember that specifically. I don't.
Well, is it going to become necessary for an employee in Texas when business conditions develop to the point where they're going to have to let some people go, say we've got to be real careful about how we discharge these people that we're going to have to in order to survive?
No, Your Honor, I don't, because the other jurisdictions that have adopted this, that was one of the objections that were made, and as you know, the restatement of torts, this particular portion was adopted in 1965. South Carolina that adopted this tort a number of years ago has not found that that would be a problem. And despite the fact that in the intervening times from 72 with the Alcorn case, which is in 1970, which is 22 years old, we haven't seen this floodgate in the states that have adopted this, even despite the court takes notice that we've had changes in our economy when it goes up and down. So to answer that, no, that's not a problem.
How can a Court of Appeals opinion here be squared with Chief Justice Phillips writing in Diamond Shamrock?
Carefully, to be very honest, not to be flippant. I think what the Chief Justice held in the Mendez case was that malice was required in a false light case. When I read the footnotes and then went and started to brief each of those individual 27, 28, I think, County, California, 29 cases, I think that it has to be recognized that that is a possibility. That could have been a possibility had there have been evidence raised of that. But there's an important factual distinction between Mendez and this case, and the factual distinction is this. In Mendez, the facts show that the gentleman admitted that he, quote, messed up, and he told his supervisor, I shouldn't have done this. He technically was guilty of theft. Now, it was still, I'll admit, fairly outrageous, but by the same token, the facts of Mendez are not the facts that you have here. You had an employee who started out actually in December of 79 with this company and worked up and became the head of their personnel and director of human resources, who with no warning whatsoever after receiving all sorts of bonuses and the most excellent evaluations that you could possibly have, was fired.
Does that constitute outrageous conduct?
Which?
What you just said.
That is part of it. I'd say that's a good part of it, yes. And I think
well, doesn't that conflict with the at-will doctrine?
Well, there are a number of things that are exceptions to the at-will doctrine.
Counsel, I think what you're trying to paint a picture of circumstances, the way I read you. Are you saying that alone might not suffice to constitute outrageous conduct, but in combination with the other events and circumstances in conjunction with and following the termination, it constituted an outrageous situation?
Exactly. And the court noted that, I think, the Court of Appeals in this, and if you go back and read the American International Medical International case out of Houston, the court made that very statement that there was no one event in that situation that satisfied the requirement of outrage.
But if you terminated someone simply by sending them a pink slip, and they opened it up and then just went to pieces, would that be outrageous conduct?
Probably not, no.
Could be, though.
Tell me the other facts.
It was at Christmas.
Okay. People get fired at Christmas all the time.
But that could be outrageous.
No, I don't think it would meet.
As a matter of law? Or?
No. I think that it depends on the circumstances, but remember it's going to impose severe emotional distress. But would the public say this is an outrage?
Well, that's what I'm getting at. It couldn't be a matter of law.
That, in essence, no. As a matter of law, I would probably say just given those few facts, it would not.
The customary practice of that employer was to call people in and tell them very sympathetically that they were very sorry, but under the circumstances and the economy and cutbacks and what have you, that they were going to have to terminate everybody, but they were giving everybody a termination check, a severance check to readjust and try to tide them over until they could find other employment.
Sure.
And this person was the only one of all of them that just got a pink slip and no more.
Well,
how about that?
I would say that in that situation, I don't think that any of the other 28 jurisdictions would have found that that's outrageous. Did it inflict severe emotional distress? Yes, but it is not an outrage. It doesn't meet the first test, as I read the 46th restatement of test.
What about if the employer said, John, I'm going to give you a $1,000 termination bonus. We hate to let you go. Tom, I'm going to give you a $500 termination bonus because I don't like you as well as I do John. Bill, I'm going to give you a package of cigarettes and tell you to go catch cancer. What about those circumstances?
Well, that I would like to know some other facts. For example, did they, in CASAS, did they have excellent evaluations? Was there an ongoing government investigation?
What you're saying is all the surrounding circumstances determine whether or not this particular conduct, this particular time, this particular incident is outrageous.
Yes, sir. And if you will look at all of these 28 opinions and all of the Court of Appeals, the Houston Court of Appeals, the Austin Court of Appeals, all of them go into to great depth in the facts. And even Chief Justice Nye, in his dissenting opinion, states when you use racial slurs, that certainly can be, especially to an employee, and then fire them. That's outrageous conduct.
So is outrageousness a question of fact or for the jury to resolve, or is it a question of law for the court to resolve in the first instance?
All of the cases that I have read said that you, and I agree, that and the comments to the restatement of torts, state that the court has to make a threshold decision whether there are enough facts before it to reach the fact question, the same as courts do in all cases. So to answer your question, the court has to make a finding that as a matter of law, I believe that there's sufficient evidence to go to a jury. Then after it does that, if the court says yes, there is, you have a jury question. If the court says no, then you do not. And if you will read all of these court of opinions, I think that's precisely what they're saying. I think it's also important for this court to recognize an important public policy statement that I think may be made in this court. And that is that in situations like this, that job performance evaluations are important.
In this case, given this lady's job performance evaluations and past employment history, if the manner in which she had been terminated had been different, would that eliminate the outrageous element of contingencies?
That would be very difficult for me to answer, because I think part of the outrage was the fact that they did escort her off. They called her in late in the afternoon with no warning whatsoever, just having finished giving her a good evaluation and given her a bonus and told her to get out. We're having them take off, get off of the premises. You have 5 minutes. You collect your things and get out of here. So if it were different, be a closer call.
But you're not saying that was not the policy with everybody that was terminated?
I don't believe it was, Your Honors, and I did look over the depositions and read them, but I believe that that did come up and that there was a statement made that it was not the general policy. And it doesn't make good sense anyway. I mean, I don't think a company is going to have a policy that says every employee that is discharged shall be escorted off in 5 minutes.
Well, it might depend upon, as the opposing counsel said, this was a defense industry?
That
where
was,
security was important? Wouldn't that make a difference?
They made the MREs when I was in the service, the old C rations, and that was the majority of what they did at the MRE division. But this company had other things that did certainly, and other customers other than that. I don't recall that from that security was a problem as outlined, but I could be corrected. The record in this is just voluminous. So I think that it is important for this court to make a statement today, at least that if we're going to move into the 21st century, that we need to use the tools of the 21st century. And one of those tools that we can do and furthering the public policy of protecting employers and employees is utilization of written job performance evaluations. I think it's important for us to realize that the Court of Appeals put quite a bit of emphasis on that. And I think there's a reason for that. And that is because the public policy in the 20th century, going into the 21st century, should be that they are useful tools. They're being used more and more by companies, by governmental bodies, et cetera. Consider, if you will, what this court would be stating to the Court of Appeals and the others if it says that, in effect, that Deanna Costa should not get her day in court. It's going to be stating that job performance evaluations cannot be used by employers or employees.
Can you terminate an employee with a good job evaluation who is an at-will employee without raising the question of whether there's been a tort involved?
Well, that goes to answer your question, that meets the first threshold of the restatement of torts requirement, and that is, what was the relationship between the plaintiff and the defendant, and did the defendant have the power to carry it out? You meet the two requirements that stated in the comments to the restatement, and that is, in this instance that you gave to me, the defendant being and the employer, did have the power to cover, to discharge to an employee. But a simple discharge because of evaluation, I would say that's getting awfully close. There's got to be something else going on. And that's what I think that the Court of Appeals saw here, is that this, there's something else going on here. This type of conduct doesn't happen for no reason, for no good reason. There is a reason for it, and I think that's what the court did in its extensive fact-finding. I read a number of the cases that the court cited in Mendez. The one that I think is the most appropriate is the Aegis case out of Massachusetts. And this was the case cited by Chief Justice Phillips where a waitress was called in by her supervisor at Howard Johnson's. All the waitresses were called at a 3 p.m. meeting. The supervisor announced, okay, gals, it was all women, we've got a problem here. There's thefts here at the Howard Johnson's in the Boston area. None of you will admit to it, so guess what? I'm going to start firing you one at a time, and since none of you will admit it, we're going to do this alphabetically. Well, it just happened that Miss Aegis was the first one whose name began with A, so she got fired. No problems with it prior to that time. The court said this is a sufficient outrage. Now compare that to what we have in Casas. In Casas, she happened to, like Ms. Aegis, be in the wrong place at the wrong time. She happened to have information and be a thoroughly honest employee, a person who would not, in her opinion, as she stated, would not corrupt herself to lie to the federal authorities. She happened to work for the wrong company at the wrong time in the wrong setting. So I would state to the court that
why,
I think
why
that...
Why didn't he try to... try this case on a whistleblower type of theory of the type that the court did not recognize in the Houston Chronicle case but left the door open to it, and there was a concurring opinion that gave some guidelines.
Yes, sir. Well, I of course, raised this with the Court of Appeals, and as I understand the rules governing, this court can go back and look at the arguments that were raised by in this case, the respondent in the Court of Appeals to see if they could, there was a cause of action for any of the points of error brought by the Court of Appeals, which we did. There were four theories, and that was one of them. So I would simply state to the court that I believe that the court can make an important decision today. And I think that the court can say, number one, that the Court of Appeals could reasonably conclude, based upon the totality of the circumstances, looking at all of it, that there was sufficient evidence, that there was sufficient evidence for this question to go to the jury. And secondly, I think that this court will be stating that it joins the 28 other jurisdictions in moving Texas into the 21st century and adopting 46 Restatement of Torts, Second, 1965.
I'm not sure I fully understood your answer to Justice Phillips' last question, Chief Justice Phillips.
As I understand, your question was concerning our arguments of Sabine Pilot in the lower courts.
Yes, and why that wasn't why that was not pursued here.
Well, Deanna Casas did not turn them in for what they had done wrong and then fired. The court made what I consider and I have all respect for the justices who wrote the opinion and the dissent. The court said, well, that doesn't meet precisely Sabine Pilot because she, you're saying she was fired because she had information and she wasn't going to lie to the federal authorities that walked in the next morning to investigate the padding of profits by MRE. So I think they made that distinction. I frankly disagree with it. And I think there is a lower court that also disagrees with it, and I'm not sure that this court has ruled definitively on that. But I cannot distinguish it myself because I don't see the distinguishing marks.
You said Sabine Pilot, but you're referring, as I believe the Chief Justice was, to Winters against Houston Chronicle.
Oh, I'm sorry. I can't comment on that case, Judge. I'm sorry, I thought he said Sabine Pilot.
Counsel, your opposing counsel articulated sort of the colloquialism by which we describe employment will. That is, you can fire somebody for a good reason, no reason, a bad reason, or no reason at all. Do you agree with that description or that of the employment will doctrine?
No, sir. No,
how,
sir.
How do you differ?
That's been disavowed by these courts. To make that statement, and in, by no means derogatorily, but that's a 19th century statement. I do not think the counsel can say here that they could have fired Ms. Casas because she was Mexican-American, spoke Spanish, or was married or unmarried.
Well, now, a lot of these matters are covered by law, both state and federal, some of the reasons you just gave. When the legislature crafts these laws, they take certain realities into account. For instance, there's usually a size below which companies are not covered, or our employers are not covered, because a single employer with a single person working for them, it may be more important to have a personal relationship with a company. It can't be quantified. The court, if it makes a, if it creates a tort, has to operate as a rather blunt instrument, does it not?
Pretty much so. Yes, sir. But it's no different from what the other 28 states. Read the South Carolina case and the opinion in Mendez, precisely with the court, the Oregon Supreme Court. And they've lived with this, some of them, for 23, 24 years.
So you can no longer, an employer can no longer fire someone for a bad reason if it's prohibited by a statute?
No. As long as that is not an outrageous reason, reaching 46 restatement of torts, or another statutory exception, or another judicial enactment such as Sabine Pilot. So I think there are many exceptions, I'm saying, to the at-will doctrine. I don't take that as a good reason, no reason, lots of reasons.
So an employer can fire somebody for a bad reason as long as it's not prohibited by a statute or by a court decision?
That is correct, yes. And that's what all of them hold. I have no problems with that.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
May it please the court, to follow up on the immediate previous comment, that's precisely what the court below held, that this plaintiff, Ms. Casas, was fired for a lawful reason. To transcend the law to now say that a bad reason, although not unlawful, gives rise to a tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress is where we propose the law, the line has to be drawn. I do want to point out to the court on the supplemental transcript 206-207, which is in the record in response to whether it was a common practice. There is deposition testimony from Ms. Casas herself in the record that was a common practice. I'd finally like to deal with the issue of the circumstances, sort of where's the beef? Where is the conduct here that is extreme and outrageous? The supervisor, everyone admits, called the employee in and gave the employee performance-related reasons. That can't be outrageous conduct, even if the employee disagrees with those reasons.
They said she was insensitive. What were those reasons?
That she wasn't performing well, she didn't respond to her supervisor's demands, that she wasn't coming up with programs and policies that her supervisor, who also was a female, wanted her to come up with. She wasn't meeting time demands of her supervisor.
But these things had not been brought to her attention at the previous evaluations.
That's of course a factual dispute, but we say that's not material. Whether it was brought to her attention or not is immaterial because the reason articulated or the reason for the termination, if it's lawful, is immaterial. Indeed, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, in anticipating this court and interpreting the law as expressed by the lower court's decision, has said that discriminatory reasons in violation of statute are not outrageous.
Counsel, do you agree, however, that under given circumstances, a chain of events considered in toto could constitute an outrageous circumstance? You're taking each of these events in isolation and saying this doesn't constitute outrageousness, and this doesn't constitute outrageousness, and this doesn't constitute outrageousness. Is it possible that even though each of these incidents, each of these elements considered alone does not rise to the level of outrageousness, that in combination they could?
I would say that that conceivably they could. I can't conceive of the fact situation where, as it exists here, where these events could ever be meet the threshold of atrocious, intolerable, beyond all possible bounds of decency standards articulated in the Restatement of Torts. I don't disagree with Chief Justice Phillips' language in the Mendez case that a discharge could be accompanied by conduct that is outrageous. In this case, it wasn't. The conduct has to be examined as it exists by the actor, not in in a chain of circumstances, in my view. And I would also point out that in this particular case, as opposed to the case in the Diamond Shamrock case, there was no communication to a third party. No one called this woman a thief. No one called her anything. No one did anything in the community or with respect to other employees.
You stated earlier that she told her co-workers that she was going to leave with absence.
Did
she have an opportunity, given 5 minutes to clean out her desk, did she have an opportunity to talk to anybody?
She went down to her office, and she had two co-workers who observed her. There were two co-workers in her office, and she told them that she was going on a leave of absence. And those were the events. That's in her deposition and in the record.
Was there any attempt at the trial court level to plead or establish in the summary judgment evidence any kind of whistleblower exception to the employment at will doctrine along the lines that I suggested in the concurrence of the Winters against Houston Contract?
No, there wasn't. In this particular case, it was argued, and in fact the plaintiff herself said that she didn't ever refuse to do anything and didn't tell anyone anything prior to her discharge. The issue here was her subjective belief that I may be in possession of information that a government auditor, if the person comes around and asks me, might want to know. And that was her subjective belief as to the reason for her termination. That's in her deposition transcript, which is cited in the brief.
But she had not shared that with anyone.
She had not shared that with anyone prior to her termination.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the second argument, and the call of the court will now take another brief recess.
The audience will please rise.